Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. ThriveInFinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Tess McLund. What if you could take money from the government, then give it back a few years later with no penalty, and have Uncle Sam turn around and send you even more? Welcome to a little program called Social Security.
The Social Security redo is what it is. It's quite amazing. They don't charge interest, and you can deduct the repayment from your income taxes.
Yes, it's true and legal. We'll explain how to do it. And if you're on Social Security, a caution that you may be a prime target for this dubious product.
They try to sell you a prepackaged living trust that's one type for everybody. And unfortunately, I think it's a big disservice for the people that buy into that.
Our series on estate planning continues. We're not quite 6 feet under on this edition of Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. I remember back in the day, I could fill up my tank for 99 cents a gallon. Ah, those were the good times. Oh, 6 years and almost $4 ago? What exactly happened? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
Premiums going for $4.99 a gallon at the station up the street from us here at Marketplace. No doubt we will cross that $5 barrier before Independence Day. Mass transit systems are reporting record ridership as drivers flee their cars. But how exactly did we reach this point? And what exactly goes into that per-gallon price tag? Here to explain is Severin Borenstein, director of the University of California Energy Institute. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back.
You have watched oil prices for years. You've studied this. Can you make heads or tails of why we have seen, a doubling in the price of a barrel of oil just in the last 6-8 months?
Yeah, I think there actually is a pretty straightforward market story about what's happened, not just in the last year, but over the last 5 years. 5 years ago, we had prices down in the $20 to $30 a barrel range, and demand was growing pretty strong, and supply was keeping up with it. But supply was stopped growing nearly as quickly, and what we have seen over the last 5 years is demand has continued to move forward on a worldwide basis, and supply hasn't. And so the only way you can make that market clear with the limited supply is for price to go way up. So we got people buying slightly more oil than they were buying a year ago and paying twice as much. But if the price were still $60 or $40 a barrel, there'd be way too much demand and the market wouldn't be able to supply it.
I guess I can understand that on a months and years basis. But let me ask you about what happened a couple of weeks ago. We had a 2-day spike of, $16, $17 a barrel, where we went up to $140 a barrel. How does that happen in 2 days? Because there's no way you can argue that all of a sudden, over those 2 days, demand went up and supply went down.
No, that clearly isn't a supply and demand story in the typical sense. But the market is constantly trying to catch up with what's really going on. And sometimes the market figures out demand is stronger than they thought or there's less supply than they thought. Often these sorts of spikes occur around either announcements of changes in inventories or political events that are going to change the available supply. And those are the sorts of things that have always rattled the market a little bit. But when you're in a very tight market to begin with, then suddenly if you have a little more demand relative to supply, you're likely to see a big price spike.
Why is it that gasoline prices seem to go up automatically when the price of a barrel of oil goes up? When refiners are buying that oil, isn't that for 3 months out from now?
Well, the refiners are buying oil for a month or two in advance, but when they sell gasoline, they have to replace that by refining more oil. So the real value of that gasoline, the real cost of selling that gasoline is what it's going to cost to replace it. It's no different than if you buy a house. When you go to sell it, what you bought that house for is not relevant. What matters is the supply-demand balance for housing when you go into the market to sell your house. And the oil companies do the same thing when they are selling the refined products.
Is it possible to calculate what we all could potentially have to pay per gallon if oil prices stay the way they are?
The way you translate it is every time the price of oil goes up by a dollar a barrel, that shows up at the pump as about 2.5 cents a gallon. So at $130 a barrel, the price of just the oil going into the gasoline is over $3 a gallon. So you're just starting from there. You add on the taxes, you add on a little for the retail dealer, and you're quickly up and over $4 a gallon. As long as oil prices stay in the $130 range, we're going to see gas prices over $4 a gallon nationwide.
And if you look into your crystal ball, is that going to stick with us?
The best predictor that I know of is the futures market for oil, and what it's saying is that these prices are likely to stay at this level for a long time to come. Now, that's not a great predictor. They're often wrong, too, but these are traders who have their own money on the line, and it's probably a better guess than any one pundit. $130, $140 oil is likely to be a real price for a long time to come.
Severin Borenstein is director of the University of California Energy Institute at Berkeley. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
You may have heard the big news in the mortgage mess this week. A couple of hedge fund managers indicted for their role in pushing subprime mortgage investments, and a slew of borrowers, real estate agents, and lenders arrested for mortgage fraud. We'll talk details with Chris in just a bit. Meanwhile, the government is pushing the banking and real estate industries to do more about the foreclosure problem through its Hope Now program, because so far it's not generating a whole lot of hope. Marketplace's Jill Barchet reports.
Colleen Buckman is a massage therapist in Minneapolis. Back in December, she decided to redo her adjustable rate mortgage. It was about to reset to more than 11%, which she couldn't afford.
They had me send all my financial information, and so I did. I was in constant communication with them for the past 6.5 months and constantly got, oh, yeah, another 15 days. Oh, 30 more days.
While she waited for a response, her monthly bill skyrocketed.
I just scrambled to make my life work and juggled money around and borrowed money from friends for 5 days while I waited on another paycheck and to make sure that I always was not delinquent.
Turns out she might have had more luck if she had been delinquent. Cheryl Peterson manages a foreclosure prevention program for Habitat for Humanity. She says many clients are often unable to get the attention of a servicer for months until they go into foreclosure.
When you're working with a lender that long, it can seem like they really do want to foreclose. So it's very stressful to homeowners.
Please hold while we transfer your call.
Mortgage servicers say they're listening, but they've got problems too. Any change to a mortgage has to be approved by the investors who actually own the loan. Still, 27 mortgage servicers signed on to a new set of guidelines designed to make them more responsive. Faith Schwartz is executive director of the Hope Now group that drew up the plan.
5 days is the request to get back to them once a request has been made. 45 days, the commitment is, they'll give them an answer.
Borrowers seeking a workout should get a simple yes or no. But these new deadlines are voluntary and non-binding.
This is meant to continue to encourage phone calls to servicers or to third-party housing counselors. It is no secret that 1 out of 2 people that get foreclosed upon don't ever talk to their servicer.
Advocates for homeowners say these timetables won't do much to stop the tidal wave of foreclosures. John Taylor is the president of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition.
What you really need is a reduction in principal and or interest rate. And if we don't do that, we're going to continue to see the foreclosure numbers, and we're going to continue to see the impact on the economy.
Back in Minneapolis, Colleen Buckman managed to avoid foreclosure. In the end, she brought in a mortgage counselor to help. The mortgage servicer finally replied this week, and Buckman's eligible for a workout. I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, joins us now for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, I think we had a little bit of comeuppance for the subprime crisis this week, did we not?
The Justice Department, the regulators are cracking down and they're coming down with indictments.
Yeah, we had a couple of Bear Stearns hedge fund managers arrested and indicted on securities fraud related to the subprime crisis. And then we also saw apparently more than 400 people have been arrested in a sting that also involves the subprime mortgage crisis. And you've heard the name of this?
Operation Malicious Mortgage.
Oh, they're very good at naming these things. Let me put on my indignant investor hat. Where were the regulators to keep this from happening in the first place?
One of the things that came out of the indictments of the Bear Stearns, there's information the regulators wouldn't have until something really bad happens. And can I just give you an example?
Sure.
Page 14 of the indictment, they have an email from Mr. Tannen. It's on April 22nd. And he says, look.
This is Matthew Tannen, one of the hedge fund managers.
Right. So if we believe the CDO report, this is talking about those fancy, complex, securitized mortgages that they owned, anywhere close to accurate, I think we should close the funds now. Then you go to the public conference call with investors a few days later. And what does he say? So from a structural point of view, from an asset point of view, we're very comfortable with exactly where we are. Hello?
How is this still happening? Why can't we catch this?
Because regulators rely on the sophisticated, well-funded institutional investor who were investing in hedge funds to monitor the situation. So they're basically not paying a whole lot of attention to it.
Why would regulators be relying on institutional investors to police this? Aren't the regulators the police?
We've lived through an era, 25, 30-year era of deregulation. And at the core of deregulation is this belief that the institutional investor, the person that really has their money on the line, they have an incentive to really monitor and understand what's going on and to be really aggressive and tough with the fund managers. The regulators are overseeing a vast market. They've got a lot of different information coming to them. So in a sense, there's a partnership between the regulators and the institutional investors. If it turns out that the institutional investors are also swept up in what's going on, and they're not paying a whole lot of attention, and the regulators are swept up with what's going on, and they're not paying a whole lot of attention, that's when the system fails.
Anything you want to say about Operation Malicious Mortgage, which is the other half of what happened this week?
I think that's the really important investigation, and that's where I think real changes are going to happen in the market. Look, it is very clear that a lot of low-income minority neighborhoods in this country that they were sold a bill of goods, call them subprime mortgages. And that is the scandal. And you can walk around a lot of neighborhoods in Los Angeles, out here in Minneapolis. You can go to New Jersey, and you will see the genuine effects of boarded up homes in foreclosure. And that's why I think that's where the focus should be.
Our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks.
Next, we look at a way to get more money out of Uncle Sam by stretching Social Security.
Somebody that's really clever could do this when they're at 62 and put the money away and not use it and earn income on that and then say, okay, I'm going to send it back.
And we check in with our investment club. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Back now to our investment club series. This year we're visiting with a club in St. Michael, Minnesota, as they figure out what stocks to buy, sell, and hold throughout the year.
The stock didn't do very well.
What sectors do you buy?
Prices are going to continue to go up.
Join the club.
Our last visit was on a bone-chilling, snowy night back in February. This time, the sliding door to Lynn Ostrom's basement living room was flung wide open. The 15-member Crow River Club has managed to eke out some profits, despite the stock market's abysmal performance over the last few months. Club member Ron Thorson is on the portfolio management team they created to help diversify their holdings.
I actually put our portfolio on Morningstar, and we're up the last 3 months 11%. So we've had a very good run the last 3 months.
Okay, what did you do? What are your major changes since February?
Diversification.
Yeah, one of our goals. Mm-hmm. I remember that. So is there a specific sector that you got into
energy.
Recently?
We did get into energy. National Oil, Varco, kind of that's in the rig platform. Oil services industry has done really well for us.
So oil at $139 a barrel in some ways is good for you, every way except your gas tank, right?
That's right.
Lynn Ostrom then pointed to a chart that showed the differences in their holdings in February versus today. They've battled what she called style drift, trying different investing strategies like Rule One and Navalier. And now they're preaching the simple gospel of diversification.
When you were here last, we were heavily weighted in discretionary and financial. We made the conscious decision last fall when it started to tumble to stay with those because we're long-term investors. And we took a hit because we had nothing in industrials, we had nothing in energy, we had nothing in basic materials, which were the hot sectors at the time. Well, all we've done, Tess, is rolled some money into those sectors now that we should have been in the first place.
So they've bought into that oil well company that Ron mentioned, also the tech company Infosys out of India. At the meeting, they also discussed the pros and cons of buying into another technology company, SAP. And they're still trying to decide whether to take a bite of Apple, which the day of the meeting was selling at $181 a share. Diane Windingland started a discussion of some of the club's research.
I thought for the sales growth and the earnings per share growth that really Ron wasn't too far off, I would have maybe gone a little more conservative to 20% for each, which also happens to be our club rule for a maximum.
You know, my earnings grow and EPS, or sales and earnings, is more in line with Diane's. It's essentially the same. You know, I pulled off an article off of Bloomberg today. All the Apple analysts are saying it's a buy because of their new iPhone. But
the price fluctuates so much on this stock. I don't want to buy too high, and I'd rather be conservative.
I don't want to bet against Steve Jobs, though.
No,
there's
I
a handful of people that
he's pretty good
that are always bringing out winners.
And people want to pay for growth. I mean, this is a growing mm-hmm. company,
right.
And it has a lot of three good product lines that have a lot of promise. So,
and based on what we're looking at, we want to buy below of $150.60 right here.
So for you, it would be overpriced right now.
It would be way overpriced.
Yeah.
They also engaged in a spirited discussion about their current holdings in Lowe's and the luxury handbag retailer Coach, which Kim Windingland pointed out has done quite well for them.
I think Lowe's is going to be going through a very difficult time next year.
I don't want to get rid of our Lowe's, but I certainly don't feel bad cutting it back. What percentage is that?
Just reduce our position. 100%. If the comfort level is not high enough to sell some of Lowe's and buy an 800 in Coach, I would like to propose amending the motion to buy 600 in Coach rather than 5.
I would be amenable.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Nay.
One opposed, well, the ayes have it.
And so the diversification effort continues. We'll check back with Crow River in the fall. By the way, you might remember during our last visit, they mentioned the club's big social outing of the year, something they call a black powder keg party, where they go to a range and shoot antique muzzle-loading guns. Well, we've got photos from that event earlier this month. They're on our website, marketplace.org. How soon should you start taking your Social Security benefits? Start early, your check will be a lot smaller. Hold off, and you can boost the payout by around 8% for every year you wait until you're 70. But there are risks. As Marketplace's Bob Moon reports, when it comes to Social Security, it is your prerogative to change your mind.
If you're kicking yourself now for starting your benefits too early, here's what you may not know. You can magically restart the clock at a higher rate.
It's like finding money on the street. This is really what we're talking about.
Boston University economics professor Lawrence Kotlikoff writes about this in a new book called Spend Till the End. He says you can return what you've already received and the government will call things even.
The Social Security redo is what it is. It's quite amazing. They don't charge interest and you can deduct the repayment from your income taxes.
Sound too good to be true? It may be for those who just aren't able to give it all back. Pat Kropp is a Social Security beneficiary in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. When we approached her with this idea, she initially counted herself out.
I mean, I would have to come up with $45,000, $50,000 just for myself. And that's excluding if my husband wanted to do that. And I don't know that I want to dip into my retirement money to do that.
Fair enough. Our experts say it's a good idea to consult with a financial planner or use special software that's available to crunch the numbers and make sure you'll really benefit. But Professor Kotlikoff says retirees shouldn't be afraid to draw from their investment nest egg to lock in what amounts to a sure thing insurance policy. It's cheaper than buying an annuity and less risky than keeping the money in a 401k.
It's going to be safer for sure. You know, the stock market is a wild ride. If they have most of their money coming in the form of an annuity and a small amount that they invest in the stock market, well, economists would view that as kind of a safe allocation. But if they have most of their resources in the stock market, that's a pretty risky option.
Think about this. Even if you don't have the means to repay the Social Security money you've already spent, T. Rowe Price financial planner Christine Fallon says in the long run, it might be worth finding a way.
If the younger generation is concerned about maybe someday having to support their parents financially, they might be willing to help out with this trade, as it were, because in the end, the family could end up winning financially.
Social Security beneficiary Pat Kropp decided the idea is worth running past her financial planner and her brother, who happens to be approaching his eligibility age.
Somebody that's really clever could do this when they're at 62. And put the money away and not use it and earn income on that and then say, okay, I'm going to send it back.
Professor Kotlikoff agrees it could be worth taking Social Security early just to use it as an interest-free loan. But one word of caution.
The risk here is that the government may change the rules. It may get to a point where so many people do this that the government says, hey, we're losing money on this and we're going to shut this down.
For now, Kotlikoff says the main benefit is for those already drawing Social Security who can substantially boost their real income and guarantee a higher lifelong payout to whichever spouse lives the longest.
Even for people age 63 to age 75 in that range, there's a significant gain to living standard to be had here.
Benefit recipient Pat Kropp is intrigued by all this, but she's still wondering what many of us might be. Is it really worth paying back such a big lump sum?
I don't know. I may not live that long. So there's always that question.
Christine Folland at T. Rowe Price understands that kind of skepticism.
You know, it's like so many financial decisions. In fact, I would say most financial decisions, there are trade-offs to be made. We leave money on the table every day when we buy homeowners insurance and our house doesn't burn down. But we think that's a good thing.
And if you should survive to 105... look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here is the best part. You have a head start.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriven.com/retirement. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more online at saveandinvest.org.
It's time for Getting Personal, when we answer your money questions. And with me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
How you doing, Tess?
Doing all right. So let's go ahead and hit the phones. Our first caller is Joe, and he is in Dearborn, Michigan. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Tess and Chris. My question is,
We're in the process of buying a home, and we have the option of paying for it by cash. You know, if I was buying this with a mortgage, the lender will, you know, make sure we're doing things right.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're doing this by cash, I'm wondering what we need to look out for. Does a title company do more, or is it really the source of where we do things right?
Obviously, Chris, when you do this the way most people do it and you get a mortgage through a bank, they're going to insist on appraisals and title searches and all that sort of thing. So how do you do this without the bank's help?
The simplest way to do it is you hire a local real estate lawyer. It's not going to be very expensive. They'll make sure that you have all the paperwork that's needed. Your administrative costs are going to be a lot less than what tests you just rattled through, you know, a lot less paperwork. Usually the seller is going to have their variety of representatives. That's the first point. And in this environment, in any environment, frankly, but in this environment in particular, if you're making an all-cash offer, you should have some real negotiating power, because remember, you don't have to get qualified. Your FICO score could be zero. And with all cash, you just do that transaction. So you are an incredibly valuable buyer, and it gives you negotiating power, and hopefully you can use it.
Chris, what are some of the specific things that he'll want to make sure that he does get done, again, that a bank would usually make sure that you do?
Well, you know, a number of things you want to make sure is there are no liens on the property. You know, in other words, no one has said, you know, you owe X amount of dollar. You want to make sure that if there are any environmental laws that need to be fulfilled before it can be sold, that that has been done. You want to set up yourselves in terms of your payment of your state and local property taxes. So, you know, there's a variety of things you're going to go through. But can I just raise one other point here, Joe?
Sure.
Not having a mortgage is a great thing. But again, I always want to give that cautionary note. You are tying up a fair amount of cash in one piece of property, one asset. Is that exactly the right thing for you to be doing at this time in your finances? If it is, terrific, go ahead and do it. But I just want to give that cautionary note that sometimes, just for purely financial reasons, not psychological, it can make more sense to put a huge down payment down, but still have a little bit of mortgage so you have access to that cash for other purposes.
All right, does that help answer your question?
You know, I figured there was a specialist involved, and the real estate lawyer, that's what I'll be looking for.
Okay, well, good luck.
Thank you.
If something about your finances is a little unclear, we'll try to help. Just visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Let's reach into the email bag, and Shelley writes in from Kansas City, Missouri. Chris, her daughter recently graduated from pharmacy school. And during her 6 years in college, the daughter borrowed $30,000 in loans. Now she wants to consolidate. And as we know, there are issues with loan consolidation these days because of the credit crunch. Some of her loans are from Sallie Mae, some from the American Education Services, AES. The interest rate is about 9%. Now, she has been told that her credit is great, but she has too much outstanding debt, so she cannot consolidate. What's going on here? Does she have any options?
That's not why she can't consolidate. If you go back to July 2007, last year, and you look at the stock market's down 12%. You look at an index of financial services stocks, down around 36%. You look at Sallie Mae stock, down 59%.
Ouch.
What is happening is, because of financing troubles among the student loan lenders, a lot of them are pulling back from consolidation. If you go right to the Sallie Mae website, they'll say, we're not doing consolidation loans right now. And I do have a warning bell. I was looking around and looking around. You know, someone's got to be doing some consolidation loans. I did find one or two, but they were floating rate at 6.5% above LIBOR. And there was kind of a teaser rate here. And I'm going, you know, this is how people got into trouble with their adjustable rate mortgages. There is one other option, though, Tess, and that is to go to the Federal Direct Consolidation Loan Center, which you can get through the Department of Education. And she might be able to qualify for a direct consolidation loan. So this is, you know, basically you're just working directly with the government. If she has a direct loan, or if she has what's called a Federal Family Education Loan, that FFEL that you see a lot of times, then she may be able to do some consolidation through the federal government through its direct loan program. My guess is the answer is no, but hey, it's an option to pursue.
Well, thanks so much for writing in, Shelley. We appreciate it and hope we answered your question. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link on our webpage. And stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This week, FedEx added itself to the list of industries hammered by high oil prices. Fuel costs sucked up 14% of the company's fourth quarter expenses. Who else is on that list? Cowboys. The LA Times reports rodeo riders spend more time driving than roping, so fewer of them are showing up to events. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we ride side saddle with the real McCoy.
I'm Ian Bridge. I'm the ranch manager at Elkin Creek Guest Ranch in Namaya Valley, British Columbia, Canada. Been here ever since as the ranch cowboy, Mr. Fix-It, everything. On a small ranch, you do anything and everything. You can't make a job list of what I'm going to do until you actually get out there and have a look. You have to learn how to ride a horse, how to fix fence, how to minor repairs on machinery. You're a long ways from town on most ranches, and you just have to be an all-around general handyman, willing to do anything in all kinds of weather. You don't even consider a 40-hour week. A few years ago, I caught some wild horses, feral horses, depends who you talk to what they are, but they were generations in the wild, and I've been told by a few other people that caught these horses, once they're more than 4 years old, just leave them in the wild because you can never trust them. And I found that to be true, because the one old mare I kept, she never quietened down. Catch her to do anything with her, you roped her, you got the halter on, she'd try and bite you. It's a dangerous occupation. You just have to be careful. I made a stupid move the other day. Went to catch a horse. The horse turned to run off and caught my toe on a rock in the pen, and I am now on crutches with a cracked ankle bone. The toughest part in the cowboy, the ranch end of it, is fighting Mother Nature to get the hay to grow in the start of the season, and then you're fighting it again. It's a hard go the whole way through. If someone wants to become a cowboy, the first thing you have to realize is there's no money in it. You will have a living, you will have a little bit of spending money, but you better have something else in mind for a retirement plan. Yeah, a ranch hand could possibly, depends on the outfit, make anywhere from $1,500 to $2,500 a month. In this particular job, I do have dental and medical coverage. Not very many ranches would supply that as a wage package. There is probably a passion for horses in the ranching community different than the riding stables near the cities. The passion for your horse in the ranching community is, that's a good horse, he's always got me home, I got to take care of him. Some people say, but the faithful old horse will always get the cowboy home because there's a bonding there. I don't know about that, but I think that faithful old horse will get the cowboy home back to the barn at the end of the day, because the horse knows the sooner I get back there, that saddle and rider comes off and I get something to eat.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter. Coming up, we continue our series on planning for the end. Living trusts aren't just for the trust fund set.
Anybody that has a home, a car, especially people that are in business for themselves.
You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Today we continue our conversations about the end. It's called estate planning. As part of this series, we're talking to people who deal with death on a regular basis. Today, someone who oversees final arrangements.
My name is Justin Zaber. I am a third-generation licensed funeral director from Cleveland, Ohio. I am 30 years old. I did not have a will before I got married, but as soon as I did get married, because of the end-of-life issues I run into on a daily basis, my wife and I did sit down, and we did set out a will. I have not personally made my own funeral arrangements, but I have made them known to my loved ones. I guess because growing up in the atmosphere that I have, unfortunately, life is very short, and you never know when things can happen. So it just makes sense to let your wishes be known, and putting that out in the open and talking about that, absolutely. Unfortunately, not only do we have to talk about death and what they want in terms of funeral services, but we also have to get very intimate in terms of someone's personal finances. And that's especially uncomfortable at that particular time when all they want to do is have everything taken care of and truly celebrate their loved one's life. Actually, I just had a story the other day of a funeral service that we handled, where it was someone who was taking care of this woman while she was in her home, and the caretaker convinced this woman to sign over all life insurance policies, important papers to her, and basically her children were cut out of the will because there was none. The lesson there is to really get these issues out in the open, talk about them, and to take action. To sit down with a lawyer, pay the minimal amount that it takes to have peace of mind, put all of your wishes in writing and lay them out specifically and the way you would like them done.
Funeral director Justin Zaber of the Zaber Funeral Home in Cleveland. And now we're joined again by John Ventura. He's the author of Kiplinger's Estate Planning. Last week he helped us with writing a will. Welcome back, John.
Thank you, Tess.
Let's go through a living trust. And earlier in the series, we talked about the differences between a will and a living trust. But let's review again. What is it? What does it do? How does it work?
Well, what it is a legal entity that's created, a trust, where assets of yours are put into the trust. And that actually means that the assets become property of that trust. Like, for instance, if you have a car or real estate and it's transferred in the trust, the actual title of the car and the real estate is changed so that the trust becomes the owner of that property. You designate somebody that's going to be the executor, the trustee of that trust, who's going to follow your directions on how those assets are to be managed and what's to happen to them in your lifetime, and also what's to happen to them if something happens to you when you die.
Who should use these?
Anybody with, I think, and nowadays this is a lot of people, anybody that has a home, a car, especially people that are in business for themselves, should have this. If they have a certain amount of wealth and stocks, bonds, considerable amount of property, should look at a living trust.
What's the difference between a living trust and a testamentary trust?
The living trust is created while you're alive, and you're directing things. You can change the trust. You can shut down the trust. You can do a lot of different things while you're alive, and that trust is created while you're alive. A testamentary trust is something that's created in your will, and an example of that is like in Marilyn Monroe's will. She had a testamentary trust that came into existence that allowed her estate to take care of her mother and a friend during their lifetime, and then the corpus of the her estate to be given to some other person for a different purpose after they were taken care of.
How do you decide which kind is best for you and your spouse and your family?
This is an important issue. You know, there's an instinct to, again, try to do these things yourself or try to find the cheapest way to create a trust. Really, a trust should be created based upon a lot of different factors, not only your assets and what you want to have done with them, but consideration about the people that you want to benefit from that trust. For instance, I'll give you an example of how unique a trust can be. Say that you have a relative, a child that has medical problems and they're totally disabled. And one of the things that you want to achieve is that after you die, you want that child to be eligible for benefits from the government to help them in their disability. You don't want your wealth given to them in such a way that would not permit them to receive those benefits. Well, in a trust, you can create a certain kind of trust with the help of an estate attorney that actually allows that person to receive benefits from the government and still get the benefit from your assets as well. You have to have an expert to be able to do that.
I think a lot of people, their first exposure to the idea of a living trust comes from flyers that you see where companies are inviting you to a hotel to sit down and hear about this wonderful way of estate planning. Any cautionary notes there?
Yes, absolutely. These companies that invite people in and sell them on the idea of a living trust, a lot of times they make exaggerated claims like it's just going to save you taxes and do other things that actually living trusts do not do. And what they do is they try to sell you a prepackaged living trust that's one type for everybody. And unfortunately, I think it's a big disservice for the people that buy into that. Every person's life is different. Every person's estate, property, the heirs that they want to benefit are all different. So the living trust has to be customized to the individual to make sure that their goals are achieved. And you can't do that, I think, from a one-size-fits-all trust document.
John Ventura is the author of Kiplinger's Estate Planning. And John, we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Tess.
Next week, Power of Attorney. Keep sending us your estate planning questions. John will help answer them at the end of our series. That's right. Marketplace Money Summer School is back in session. We're defining some of the most confusing financial terms out there so you can dazzle your friends at the next summer barbecue. First up, LIBOR. That's LIBOR, all in caps. At the blackboard this week is Jonathan Clements.
LIBOR, otherwise known as the London Interbank Offered Rate, might seem like one of those obscure foreign financial things that Americans really don't need to worry about. But in fact, what's happening with LIBOR may be affecting the cost of your student loan, the return on your mutual fund, and the interest rate on your mortgage. LIBOR, which is calculated each morning in London by the British Bankers Association, reflects the average rate at which major international banks lend to one another. That rate, in turn, is used to calculate the rate on a slew of other financial instruments. Let's say you have an adjustable rate mortgage. Dig into the fine print and you might discover that the mortgage is repriced each year at, say, 2.5 points over 1 year LIBOR. If LIBOR is at 3.5%, you're looking at paying 6. LIBOR has existed for years and years, but in terms of its effects on American financial life, it's really ballooned over the last 10 years as more and more financial instruments get pegged to what's going on in the London financial markets. If the rate on LIBOR shoots up, Americans who have adjustable rate mortgages that are tied to LIBOR are going to feel the pain, but there's a limit to how much damage can be done. With an adjustable rate mortgage, there's usually a cap on how much the rate can increase from one period to the next. So even if LIBOR goes through the roof, an American homeowner might only see their mortgage go up by the cap, which might be just 2 points for any 1 year.
Jonathan Clements is the Director of Financial Guidance for MyFi, an advisory service from Citigroup. Next week, dollar cost averaging.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation. Online at kauffman.org.
All right, we're back with Getting Personal. And Chris, let's reach right into the email bag. And Harold writes in from Escanaba, Michigan. And Harold has no credit card debt. Wow.
Wonderful.
Good for him.
Yep.
One of the card companies sent him an offer This is new to me. I've never heard of credit card companies sending offers in the mail.
Revolutions do happen.
Yes, they do. Anyway, he got an offer of 0% APR with a 3% transfer fee. The 0% good until next June. Now, he thinks this is a great way of borrowing cheap money. I can't imagine that this is a great way to borrow cheap money to go into credit card debt. What do you think?
You know, it is a great way to borrow cheap money in one sense. You're getting a 0% rate of interest. And, you know, here's Harold has no credit card debt. So obviously he's pretty good about paying the bills. So if he did have some sort of purchase that would last for a brief period of time, not bad. But you always got to read the fine print. It drives me crazy, by the way, because if you look at the fine print, there's a lot of catches in there. And this stuff is written by lawyers, not by ordinary human beings. So it's hard to understand. But basically, if you miss a payment, if you're late on a payment, if the payment doesn't arrive with the postmark at such and such a time before such and such a moment happens, all of a sudden the rate kicks up and it may be 9, 10, 15, 20, who knows what rate it is. So typically what they're hoping, one, they want you to be a customer. Secondly, they're really hoping that you miss one of those payments. So then they can charge you a lot more than 0%. So in general, if there's something ahead of you, and you need to, you know, use your credit card and you're going to carry it for a month or two, there's nothing wrong with doing 0%. That's fine. I mean, obviously. But there is a catch. The catch is they're hoping you're late on a payment.
And we are really not in the habit of encouraging people who already have no credit card debt to go and get some.
Exactly. That's right. Just not. You know, the times that you go into credit card debt might be, oh, you know, you're taking a trip. You're going to Europe and you put your hotels and your airfare on there and you carry it for a month or two because it does take you a month or two to pay it off. I mean, I can't get upset about something like that. That's fine. And you use your credit card because that provides you certain protections if something goes wrong. But by and large, no, we are not in the habit of encouraging anyone to take on credit card debt.
Okay. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Our next caller is Brian, and he joins us from Auburn, Alabama. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Tess.
What's your question for Chris today?
Well, I've been contributing to a Roth IRA account with a large brokerage firm for about 5 years, and I'm concerned about the fees, and I'm thinking of opening a new Roth with a retail brokerage that has lower fees. I'm wondering if I'd be better off staying with a brokerage with the higher fees because I have compound interest built up there, or if I'm better off switching to the brokerage with the lower fees.
What do you think, Chris?
Okay, you will capture your compound interest if you close the account and transfer it into your new Roth IRA. So you won't be losing any of your compound interest. Now, you want to make sure it's a, you know, we call it an institution-to-institution transfer. You just don't want to get hit by any tax penalty.
Right.
And it's very simple to do. It's straightforward. You always contact the firm that you want to do business with first because they want your money. And you say, okay, I'm opening up a Roth IRA and I want to be making this transfer. How do I do it? You know, what forms need to be filled out? They'll have it on their website. They make it very simple. So you'll capture all the compound interest that you have earned up to this five-year period. And then you'll put it into your new investment. And here's what you're hoping is that you'll continue to compound, but you'll do better over a longer period of time because you'll be paying lower fees. And who knows what the future brings about, but lower fees, that's something at least we can calculate.
Right. And that's an institutional transfer.
Right. Reason why we call it institutional transfer is, let's say your money's with Chris Farrell, Inc. I've been managing your Roth and you want to transfer it to Tess, Inc. because she's got the low fee.
And better returns than Chris Inc.
And better returns. Absolutely. Yeah. All that stuff. Okay. What you want to do is you don't want to call me up and say, close my account, send me the money, then I'll send it to Tess. Uh-uh. What it is that Tess contacts me and there's all these forms that get signed and filled out, but then I transfer the money directly to Tess.
There's no tax liability at all with the institutional transfer.
No, because you're not really taking the money out.
Sure.
The money's not actually touching your hands. That's the key. So no, it's routine, it's standard, it has been set up this way so that you don't have to pay taxes, but you can decide, I don't want to continue to work with this institution, I want to work with this institution, and you don't have to pay a tax or early withdrawal penalty for making that decision.
Does that help you out?
that helps very much.
Okay, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, unfortunately, Chris, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But as we've been telling folks, you are now answering personal finance questions every weekday online. Just visit our website. It's marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link there. That'll get you to those answers. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Well, you're welcome, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And time now for your letters. We recently talked to MSN Money columnist Liz Pulliam Weston about odd insurance benefits. Liz told the story of a man who walked into his kitchen and found a snake. He grabbed an axe to get rid of it and in the process got rid of some of his floor. His insurance paid for the damage. But Pat Murray, who hears us in Durham, North Carolina, had a different tip about dealing with snakes.
Snakes would gladly be somewhere else when it comes to humans. Snakes can be caught and released fairly easily, and that's at least as safe as swinging an axe.
We got an earful about our recent look at women who make more money than the men they date. Our reporter Sean Cole tested the results of a relationship study. Diane Barth of Great Barrington, Massachusetts, says we should have tested our approach to the story.
To interview six women in the Bay Area, what does that tell us? My own husband and I have been happily living together for 31 years. The fact that I make more money than he does not intimidate him. It's just a fact based on differences in our careers.
And finally, Steve Pierce of Ypsilanti, Michigan, heard my interview with Wall Street Journal columnist Scott McCartney about the new airline fees. Scott said the airline industry was like a movie theater. You buy a ticket to watch the movie. If you want popcorn, that's extra. Mr. Pierce asks, what would a movie theater look like if run by the airlines? I would never know the price of a movie ticket, he says. And while I paid $12, the family next to me paid $4. When I get to the theater, there's a line of 200 people waiting to get in. The movie won't start on time, and the air conditioner doesn't work. Next week, you go back to the theater, and they now charge $25 to park your car. So what would your favorite activity look like if run by the airlines? Send us your scenes. Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, cheating on your spouse with Mr. Credit Card.
I had a secret post office box where I would get bills that would come to make sure that he didn't see them, because it was just easier for me to deceive him to keep what I thought was harmony in our marriage.
Uh-oh. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Stephen Hoffman, Janae Darden, James Richter, Ravi Karman, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.